got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubled mind. I've got a broken thing.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Biotech Facts and Fallacies podcast. I'm your host, Cameron English. If you've been to Burger King recently, you've probably eaten or at least seen that the fast food joint serves what's called an Impossible Burger, which is an entirely plant-based burger produced with the help of genetic engineering. And the Impossible Burger and the Beyond Burger, which is offered by Impossible Foods' biggest competitor, are incredibly popular, and you have more and more restaurants these days trying to offer these products. But you've probably also noticed that these burgers have been the subject of heavy criticism, both from traditional meat producers and also from some more radical environmental groups. And the criticisms span from the fact that these foods are so-called ultra-processed, and then that the Impossible Burger contains an ingredient that was produced with genetic engineering. And my guest today is Alex Trembath. He's the deputy director at the Breakthrough Institute, and he says that these complaints are really baseless when you look at the evidence, and he says instead that the objections to these foods have more to do with economics and more to do with political ideology than they do with anything else. And he published an article recently sort of breaking down all of these arguments, and we're going to talk through that article and try to figure out why so many people find the Impossible Burger and the Beyond Burger so problematic. All right, Alex, welcome to the show. How are you today?
Cameron, thanks for having me. I'm doing swell. How are you?
I like that word swell. I don't think I've heard that in quite a while, so good for you for being creative.
I do my best.
So this article you wrote for Medium all about the backlash against so-called fake meat. So before we get into the weeds, what does fake meat mean in the context of the article you wrote?
I mean, that's a great question. Fake meat is a sort of a catch-all term that is being used today. It basically means plant-based meat today. Things like Beyond Meat, Impossible Meat, that are using soy and yeast and other plant-based ingredients to create new compounds that resemble the taste and texture and aroma of animal-based meat. Fake meat also potentially includes things like cellular or in vitro or lab-based meat, you know, where you're taking sort of stem cells from animals and growing meat in a petri dish, or more likely in a big factory. But you know, those types of cell-based meat aren't really available on the market today. Whereas we're seeing the Impossible Burger and the Beyond Burger at Red Robin, at Whole Foods, at McDonald's, at Burger King, at White Castle. You know, so when we talk about the consumption of fake meat today, we're mostly talking about plant-based alternatives to animal-based meat.
Now, this might seem like kind of a silly question, but I think it's relevant to where we're going. So have you actually tried one? Does it taste like a beef hamburger, either one of them?
I've tried a bunch of them in a bunch of different places and preparations. I have cooked with both Beyond and Impossible. I've tried those and others. I have been more and less happy with the preparation at different places. You know, I tried the Impossible Burger basically as soon as you could in San Francisco with their first sort of formula of Impossible Meat like 3 years ago or whatever that was at Coxcomb Restaurant in San Francisco. And I thought that was good. And I think, you know, both have made big improvements in the last couple of years towards much closer resembling the taste and texture of actual meat. I would say they're both quite good. They're kind of approaching pretty typical hamburger patties. You know, nothing super flavorful or juicy, I would say. But of course, you can sort of dress that up with anything you put on a hamburger or anything you blend into the meat. I'm actually more surprised. I'm as surprised as anybody at how close I think that these plant-based alternatives to meat have gotten to the flavor and texture of at least sort of ground beef, compared to what I thought would have been possible a few years ago.
Yeah, leaps and bounds, and just even, you know, maybe the last 5 or 6 years. But the reason I ask how good it is because the success of these products really seems like it's going to come down to whether consumers like the taste of it. And so there are, I mean, it's debated, but there are these potentially really big environmental benefits, because these products arguably are better for the environment. But it's really going to come down to, hey, does it taste good when I go through the drive-thru? So that seems to be that we're off to a good start. You have these products selling so well. But let's move on to some of the criticisms. And this next phrase I'm about to utter, I can't stand saying it, but so-called ultra-processed food, that label's been applied to all of these products, I think. And I just like it because it's so nebulous. It means whatever you want it to mean, I think. And you cover that in your article. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so over the past year or so, just in my daily life, not even in my work life exclusively, I have started to notice, you know, I live in Oakland, California. There's a lot of Impossible and Beyond options at restaurants and grocery stores around us. And I had started to notice more and more people raising this criticism of the plant-based meat options. This criticism that you mentioned, that, you know, oh, it's so processed. Oh, aren't you worried about the sort of health impacts of that sort of really ultra processed food? And like you say, that sort of always rubbed me the wrong way. I've never really appreciated the whole concept of processed food, particularly as a criticism, because it doesn't mean anything. You know, as I get at in my piece, and I quote Rachel Loudon and other food scholars who have actually dug into the sort of deployment of that term processed, and it really does mean just bad in any number of ways. And it's to my mind basically impossible to categorize what level of processing is good and what level of processing is bad. So that started to rub me the wrong way, and I noticed, or at least I concluded that this newer criticism of fake meat, which I didn't hear like 2-3 years ago when it was just coming on the market, seemed to be associated with fake meat's availability in basically fast food restaurants. So, you know, not Coxcomb in San Francisco, but Burger King in White Castle, Red Robin, and places like this. And, you know, it seemed as soon as fake meat hit these sort of less elite, less classy locales, these fast food restaurants, that all of a sudden, even though it was the same formula that is used in high-end restaurants for a $20 hamburger in San Francisco, it's ultra-processed. And that is really what got me to write the essay. I noticed that this was happening at the same time as Impossible, Beyond, more of these were becoming more widely available. And I wanted to dig into that a little bit.
Yeah, and just to elaborate on that, you quote a tweet from Mark Bittman, who of course is the former New York Times columnist, big popular food writer, and he actually reversed his opinion on this, if I understand this correctly. So back in like 2012, he was optimistic and he thought this was a good idea, but now that it's starting to hit the market, he's coming out and saying, well, there's all these problems it doesn't address, and you know, we need to look at it, and so on and so forth. So let's talk a little bit more about this, and I mean. Correct my language if I'm wrong, but it seems like there's a sort of snobbery involved in the opposition to this. So it's not really scientific or ethical. It's just, you know, it rubs certain people the wrong way. So expand on that if you would.
I think I would find it more scientific or ethical if it came with an analysis, but it's more in the tune of, well, we're just raising questions. This stuff really does seem hyper-processed. You know, that was the sort of tone of Mark Bittman's tweet from a couple of weeks ago. So yeah, I mean, I would agree. And that, you know, that's sort of one of the arguments that I made in my essay, that again, now that fake meat is starting to be mass produced, although not at nearly the scale that like actual animal meat is produced, you're starting to see this elite reaction. And in some cases, as in Bittman, this elite reversal of a previous enthusiasm for it. And I start to wonder what the point of fake meat was, if it was only going to be good to sort of foodies and to the food elite, as long as it was reserved for sort of high-end restaurants, for sort of visionary chefs and sort of food utopians and food experimenters. I start to wonder what the sort of use of a plant-based alternative that has lower animal welfare and environmental impacts, if it's not going to be widely deployed at places like Burger King. And so, you know, there's a lot of sort of friction in those reactions and in those reversals that I wanted to pull apart.
And you make a couple of really pertinent observations in the article. And the first one is that it's not that these products are bad for the environment or they don't do what they say they're going to do. It's actually that they're going to do it better than people anticipated. And so if you can make the food system more sustainable without making these major adjustments, then you sort of ruin all the work that they're trying to do, right? You undermine them in a sense. And so talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so the one of the fascinating things, maybe the central fascinating thing about the fake meat space to me is how many different directions it receives criticism from. And your question gets to that concept. Exactly. Fake meat, it is designed to replicate, for the most part at this point, hamburgers, actually. You can make meatballs with it, you can make tacos, but it's mostly used to make hamburgers. And for a long time, the criticism of sort of the beef industry for either animal welfare or environmental or other reasons or all of the above was that it has these large impacts. Obviously, we're raising and slaughtering millions of animals a year. Cows belch out methane. They are responsible for a huge amount of land use in the United States and around the world. And we need to stop eating beef. We've heard that, or we need to stop eating beef the way we do. We've heard that for a long time from sort of, vegan advocacy, elsewhere, from the grass-finished beef sort of industry or whatever you want to call it, and from sort of activist chefs who have been trying to push eaters away from eating beef. And, we've heard that message for a while. And what Impossible and Beyond and the other fake meat companies actually offer is, hey, we don't actually need radical lifestyle changes. We don't need to stop eating hamburgers. We don't need to sort of completely upend the beef industry or the American food system. We can just plug this, close to perfect facsimile for cow-based beef into the exact system we have today, and pretty quickly, dramatically lower environmental impacts, and kind of eliminate animal welfare concerns if obviously fake meat scales. So that was sort of another central conclusion that I tried to surface in my essay. A lot of the criticisms of fake meat are that it's not good enough. That fake meat doesn't involve any animals, but it's too processed, and we don't know what's in it, and we don't know what the environmental impacts are. But my concern is actually, as you say, that what the problem with fake meat that these writers and these sort of food scholars have is actually that it's too good, is that it slots a little too perfectly into the systems we have today. And it's those systems, sort of mass production, fast food writ large, that are actually the problem that these people have, not fake meat.
Sure. Now, would it be fair to say that then really what they're trying to do is fundamentally change how the system works? So they can't just say, I'm a food snob and I don't really want you to eat plant-based burgers at a Burger King. So they have to come up with these different reasons that sound sort of sciencey and sort of intellectual. But in reality, it's just that they want to revamp the whole system. And you just touched on this, that they don't really like, corporations, and they don't like this mass-produced system. So is that really what the issue is? Is they just want to remake everything. They want to adopt sort of like a localist philosophy for food. Is that fair?
Yeah, and it's different depending on who's talking, depending on who is sort of criticizing fake meat. Obviously, you get fake meat criticisms from the beef industry itself, who, I can't imagine are super enthused about the idea of completely overturning the beef industry. So obviously, this stuff gets a little complicated, but that's basically right. You have this whole set of people who are sort of, maybe anti-corporate on the one hand, maybe they're anti-industrial agriculture on the other hand, maybe they're animal rights activists, maybe they're, food health professionals or whatever. And I think what gives the game away when they criticize fake meat is that, again, they don't actually sort of provide an analysis of the alleged environmental or nutritional issues with fake meat. It's all sort of hand waving, and it's all sort of, oh, we're just asking questions. It really does seem really processed. No, I mean, because if you look at the sort of nutritional composition of Beyond and Impossible and these other foods, they are remarkably similar to animal-based products. If you look at the environmental life cycle analyses that have been done on plant-based meat, they showed dramatic reductions in land use, water use, greenhouse gas emissions, and other major environmental indicators. So given that they're is actually no analysis to back up these claims about nutrition or environment, they have to sort of wave their hand, because as you say, it's sort of easier to do that and actually sort of more compelling to sort of listeners or consumers or whatever, than being sort of forthright and saying, we actually want to dismantle this whole system, or we're just anti-corporate, or we're just anti-big beef, or whatever.
Yeah, it's very interesting. We're watching it happen in real time, which is strange, but also kind of fun, just to see how people are adapting to this as time goes on. But one interesting aspect is that Beyond Meat, which is, of course, one of the big suppliers of these plant-based burgers at Carl's Jr. and Del Taco and some of these other places, they've sort of jumped on this naturalistic fallacy bandwagon. And they're saying, we don't use GMOs, you know, there's nothing artificial in our burgers. So they're, at least from my perspective, it seems like they're sort of eating at themselves. You know, it's like, why would you help your critics along? I don't understand that. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, obviously, you know, I'm a fan of the Beyond Burger. I've had it several times, and it's obviously up to the company what they want to put in it and how they want to market it. I would just say, though, that what really got my essay getting written in the first place was my colleague, you know, forwarded me a couple weeks ago the news that the CEO of Chipotle said that he will not be serving fake meat at Chipotle's because it's too processed. You know, that was sort of the latest example of this. And that includes Beyond Meat, which has for several years now been marketing themselves as the more natural, less processed kind of fake meat. You know, Impossible was actually very forthright and wrote a very long and detailed explanation of why they use genetically modified soy in their burgers, because, you know, they find, what I agree with, that it has sort of the lowest environmental impacts of sort of major forms of soy production. And Beyond has been very, very vocal about not using GMOs in their product at all. And again, sort of forwarding this unprocessed natural message. And, I would just observe that didn't earn them very much. You know, the CEO of Chipotle is not going to use Impossible or Beyond, because I don't think that the sort of concerns about processing or about GMOs are really what the problem is with these sort of new food technologies. The problem isn't with the technology itself. The problem is with the forms of mass production and with the food system at large. And I think if you don't understand that, then the way that you produce and market your hamburger or your fake meat alternative of any kind might not work out the way you planned.
Yeah, and we don't have to bash on Chipotle too much, although I admit it's a lot of fun, because, you know, like they serve soda, of course, which is sweetened with high fructose corn syrup, which, of course, in most cases comes from conventional genetically engineered corn. And then, you know, you have the flour tortillas, you have cheese that's made with an enzyme that's derived from genetically engineered yeast and bacteria. And I believe they use tofu as well, right? So they have processed products in their supply chain already, but for some reason, this is where they're going to stand and, you know, declare their moral superiority. I just find that strange.
Yeah, I can't help but wonder if Chipotle had been the first sort of fast food or fast casual restaurant to offer fake meat, if it hadn't worked out. But by the time Chipotle was considering it, I obviously don't know the internal workings of any of these restaurants, but by the time Chipotle was sort of asked the question or was considering it or made a decision about it, it was already on offer at White Castle. It was already on offer at Carl's Jr. It was already on offer at Burger King. And this sort of narrative of, oh, it's hyper-processed, we don't know what goes into it, had already started this sort of view among food elites that it was unnatural. Or that it was hyper-processed, had already begun. So it was probably a very easy business decision for Chipotle to say, no, we serve real beef. We don't serve any of that fake beef. And I would say that the term fake, you know, can't be great marketing for these companies. So I believe prefer the term clean meat. And I don't really have a particular position on that. But, you know, exactly. I look at the soy tofu sofritas that Chipotle offers, and that sure does look like plant-based processed meat to me. And the only difference is that's, I don't know, been around for a long time. And we've sort of categorized tofu as this, you know, environmentally friendly, animal welfare friendly alternative to meat. And whatever processing goes into that doesn't count in the same way that this new fake meat processing does. So again, it all sort of falls apart once you start to pick at it even a little bit.
Yeah, you didn't know that there's tofu trees? They just kind of sprout up naturally, and there it is. You just pick the tofu off, and there you go.
I learn new things all the time. Thank you, Cameron.
This is a biotech podcast, so let's say a little bit about some of the anti-GMO opposition. This isn't as widespread, but there's been a few groups. So like Moms Across America is one of these anti-glyphosate, anti-GMO groups. And so they've been saying, you know, GMO soy is actually worse for the environment. And then because of the glyphosate they use on Roundup Ready soy, it presents a health risk to parents, especially to mothers and children, and same old song and dance. But comment on that situation, if you don't mind.
Yeah, you know what actually got us very closely interested in the fake meat question before we had really spun up our own food and ag work a couple years ago was actually the genetic modification question. You know, Friends of the Earth and a couple other environmental organizations came out, again, sort of very strongly and very vocally against the Impossible Burger in particular, because Impossible uses genetic modification of yeast to sort of grow their core ingredient in the Impossible Burger, which is soy hemoglobin, which gives the Impossible Burger its sort of juicy texture and flavor. And of course, even after that, Impossible came out and said, yeah, we're just going to use genetically modified soy because it has the lowest land impact, it has the least harmful application of pesticides. You know, similar conclusions that have been made by agricultural experts, you know, for a long time now. And, you know, obviously the questions about genetic modification take on a lot of the same character as questions about fake meat. Oftentimes, you know, the sort of facial criticism is over application of glyphosate or you know, sort of seeds blowing into non-GMO fields or things like that, when the root of the problem seems to me to be much more in the sort of size, scale, scope of the industrial food system. So they're actually very similar. They're sort of very similar cognitively, at least, fake meat, genetically modified ingredients broadly.
Yeah, and I don't know if you brought this up in your article, but one of the arguments that the meat industry was making is that there's something like 46 unknown proteins in this Impossible Burger. And, you know, that could present some health risk. We just don't know. And we had an article on Genetic Literacy Project about this, but it was more or less mirroring the arguments that were made against conventional agriculture by these activist groups. And so now you see these same people who were debunking these arguments 2 years ago are now embracing them because it's convenient for their business. And I just thought that was weird. I mean, just because a protein is uncharacterized, it doesn't mean it's harmful, right? That's why the FDA does the studies it does. And it you know, gave a green light to the Impossible Burger. So do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, there's no way that the unidentified proteins at Impossible and Beyond of these other companies are going to be worse or greater than the unidentified ingredients or proteins in animal-based meat. There's a lot goes into our food, including our meat, including our produce, in terms of, you know, preservatives and in terms of the actual science behind the seeds we plant. So my main point is that sort of all modern food is scientific and technological in a major way, and you can sort of dig into the biological or chemical or atomic level to find a bunch of strange or unfamiliar components or about the food that we eat. But again, those are always deployed, almost always deployed in a sense of bad faith. You know, like you say, a lot of the same folks who are defending processed food generally, or who are defending genetic modification of soy and corn, or who are defending beef, who are defending big agriculture, are now using the same methods to attack plant-based meat because, oh, there's so many ingredients that go into it, as if that is on its own sort of a useful metric for health or for environmental impact or for animal welfare. So it is odd. And again, I keep coming back to this, but it's frustrating that more of the participants in this debate don't realize that we're mostly not arguing about the number of ingredients. We're mostly not arguing about the level of processing. We're arguing about the type of food system that we want. And, you know, when that means that people might still eat at McDonald's, even if they're eating fake meat instead of cow-based meat, then that really bothers some people who are just anti-fast food. When people might still eat hamburgers, but they might be plant-based instead of animal-based, and that obviously really bothers people who range cattle for a living. I don't, you know, I'm not, uh, I don't doubt their sincerity, or their love for their work or for their industry. But I think we could be more honest about the actual disagreements at hand, and not do a whole bunch of hand waving about length of ingredient lists or hyper processing or any of this stuff that is mostly used as a smokescreen for other concerns.
Yeah, absolutely. So you make a great point to close out the article, and we can end the interview here as well. But you caution people not to really get hung up on the minutia, like you were just talking about, whether it's too many ingredients or the process used to produce the product. You make the point that in the last 50 years, we've come so far in terms of food production and safety and availability, of course, in the United States, but in many places around the world as well. So to close us out, can you summarize that point that you were making?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I said it a couple moments ago. All food that we have today is highly technological and highly scientific. We have bred crops in a whole bunch of different ways, you know, through conventional breeding, through radiation, obviously through genetic modification, to prioritize different characteristics, whether that's, you know, whether that's resistance to drought or pests, or to increase, we've changed practices and where we grow food to increase shelf life. We've used things like single-use plastic to wrap around produce to prevent food waste at the consumer end. We are now growing meat in petri dishes and in factories. We're combining plants in new ways to resemble the shape of meat. We're farming fish. Over half the seafood eaten in the world today is from aquaculture, not from wild catch. So if you look around, you just see sort of the technological fingerprints of a sort of highly experimental, highly innovative, highly technological food system on everything that we eat. It's easy to point the finger at the new thing and say, oh, this is a scientific abomination, or this is Frankenfood or whatever. And you know, as you say, even some of the plant-based companies who are trying to get in the space do a little bit of that. And I think we would all be better served if we realized that not only is most of our food, or almost all of our food, pretty technological at this point and pretty unlike what we would be eating if humans hadn't been manipulating it at a biological and an industrial level for generations. If we just sort of understood that that is the essence of global food production, then we could actually have more informed and I think more honest debates about what type of food we want to eat and grow and what type of food system we want to have. Until then, all of these concerns about Frankenfood, about the level, the number of ingredients, about the kind or type of processing, these concerns are often, almost always, in my view, deployed as a kind of smokescreen for other concerns, and that makes it really hard to have an honest, productive conversation.
All right, very good. Well, if people want to have that honest, productive conversation with you, where can they reach you? I know you're on Twitter, you're pretty active there. Why don't you give us your Twitter handle?
Absolutely. Thank you, Cameron. I'm extremely active on Twitter, maybe too active, but to make me even more active, I'm at A. Trembath, first initial, last name. You're also welcome to come to our website, www.thebreakthrough.org. If you have any questions, you can email me, alex@thebreakthrough.org. And you know, there's probably other ways you can find me in this very modern social media age that we live in.
Yeah, no doubt. And before we go, why don't you give a little plug for what Breakthrough does? I had Dan on the podcast about a month ago now, but tell people who don't know what Breakthrough is and what you guys do.
Thanks, Cameron. Yeah, I'd strongly encourage your listeners, if they haven't already, to go back and to listen to that episode that you did with Dan Rato, my colleague and a senior food and ag analyst we have here at Breakthrough. The Breakthrough Institute has been around for a little over a decade. We are an environmental policy research center dedicated to finding environmental solutions to, or excuse me, dedicated to finding technological solutions to environmental problems. So, you know, obviously that means things like clean energy as a solution to climate change. It also means things like sort of more efficient, more productive agriculture as a solution to deforestation and biodiversity loss. And I wouldn't necessarily count on fake meat or even the fake meat compounds that we have today to do all the work of lowering the environmental impact of beef in the coming decades or the coming century. But that's one of them. You know, it's a, like I said, like all food production is a highly technological and scientific endeavor. And this is the latest example of that. And I think it's a particularly powerful one, again, given how sort of quickly and easily it slots in to the food systems that we already have and that are already delivering, you know, pretty widespread benefits to us today.
Good stuff. All right, Alex. Well, thank you for joining us. And go check out the article. We'll put a link to it on the website and check out Breakthrough. And we'll have to have you back sometime.
I'd love to be back, Cameron. Thanks for having me.
All right, everybody, thank you so much for listening. I want to remind you before we go to check out geneticliteracyproject.org. If you sign up for our newsletter, we will send you new articles and news updates, as well as these podcasts, right to your inbox. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time.